Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There will be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. This week we wrap up the weird or strange laws that we've been taking a look at from various places around the world. This one's a bit of a soft one, but I think it might make sense to some. In France, it's illegal to name a pig Napoleon. I suppose that's self-explanatory, but I thought it would be a good way to end the week. There you have it, folks. If you're in France, don't name your pig Napoleon. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the business rescue situation in South Africa. 1,400 businesses last year went into liquidation and got closed. With even more of those businesses going into business rescue. One such example is Murray & Roberts, one of the oldest businesses in South Africa, also going into business rescue from their South African division just recently. So we're going to speak to a business rescue specialist around this and try and see if we potentially could have prevented any of these companies from closing down, but also what some lessons are from that perspective. Then we've also got a conversation with MTN South Africa around their latest collaboration with Huawei and China Telecom to launch the largest smart mine on the African continent. I wonder what a smart mine is. Looking forward to seeing what the MTN team have to say around that. Then we've got a conversation with the Standard Bank Group around infrastructure in Africa, the opportunities that present themselves there, and potentially some of the challenges that are there as well. And then we wrap the show up as we do every Thursday with an SME. This week's SME is the founder of Z2B Aquaponics Farm, a farm in Soweto that's growing fish.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we start off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by senior sales trader at Momentum Securities, Odwa Makhwenju, to take a look at the market movements. Good evening, Odwa. Lovely to catch up with you. Markets today not having the best day locally, but it also kind of feels like the Thursday trading day was a bit up and down no matter which market you really looked at.
Correct. Today it seems like the losers outweighed the winners, with the trade update from production update from Sasol, for example, that really pulled the market to the bottom side. And other winners didn't do too well, such as Richmond only going up 1.4%. And I think for me it's just people sitting on their hands to wait for the big anticipated moment, which is happening right now.
That big moment is Donald J. Trump is speaking at the moment in the United States. Do we have any idea about what he intended to communicate in terms of a message? I know he typically doesn't give anybody an agenda as to what he wants to talk about. Do we have an idea of what he's saying?
I think today is going to be just setting up the tone in terms of what's happening or what his vision is for the country. We've been waiting for tariffs, and the only thing we've managed to hear is 10% tariffs on China, 25% tariffs on the EU. His neighboring parties, Canada and Mexico. But in terms of what the specifics are, I think that's what we've got to be waiting for today.
Otto, you mentioned China and the tariffs on China, but China's also been a bit of no man's land, so to speak. I mean, they've been throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, as you mentioned, at the markets, trying to stimulate their market. We got Chinese GDP data out that suggested that they actually did well last year, but seemingly that didn't seem to have a positive effect on sentiment.
The sentiment is very down right now in terms of the Chinese markets. And the issue is we never know what they're going to do. And this is kind of self-inflicted in terms of on their side. The property issue, the regulations they introduced, self-inflicted. And a lot of Chinese consumers were invested in property. And right now, we are also seeing that the Chinese consumer is not participating as previously we saw with Richmond's update, that Chinese, mainland China, is not coming to, you know, is not buying luxury goods as they usually do. We also saw that they have changed where they put placing their value, and they went into gold, hence the rally in gold last year. So the Chinese consumer is not coming to the party, and that's what's happening. So right now, also, as you said, with tariffs potentially coming about, that could go back and hurt China if the tariffs are too high. And that's why right now, as I said today, they are the state-owned companies stating that firstly, mutual funds must increase their holdings to at least 10% in the Chinese markets, and also 30% allocation from insurers must be invested in the Chinese market.
While we're looking at China, let's look at the commodity space. I mean, China's such a huge player in that space, at least from a demand perspective. We're seeing commodities prices kind of steady out and stabilize here. I'm looking at platinum and palladium, and palladium's finally back above $1,000 an ounce there, but obviously it's been kind of up and down with palladium and platinum. They've been struggling to kind of get a bit of momentum from that respect. Do you think that we could be in for a more bullish year just on the commodities front in general?
Yes, I do believe so, but it depends. A lot of factors. The stars have to align very perfectly. In terms of China, again, I think in terms of growth there, they might be looking at more software-based developments. However, there are many opportunities in infrastructure, as you mentioned in your intro, for example, in Africa and other places except for China. I think China might not be the target area for the commodities market to have a pool. And then in terms of other commodities, it all depends on which commodity you're looking at. With America's drill, baby, drill outlook right now, we could see a drop in oil prices. However, if you look on the other end, the uncertainty is definitely favorable for the gold price. Platinum, that's the unfortunate, and palladium, those are the unfortunate counterparts right now, because we're also seeing a move away from ICE vehicles.
Audra, what are you looking at for the new year? I mean, understanding that we've been through quite a bit in terms of markets over the last couple of years, and I mean, everything from the pandemic to everything that's happened since then, there's probably opportunity in a lot of different areas. But how do you approach a market like that where you kind of don't really know what to expect out of Donald Trump other than putting America first? But at the same time, markets like Europe are going into recession, markets like China are struggling along, South African markets are on the receiving end of all of these global sentiments. Where do you start to look for opportunity here?
For me, I think it's you start at volatility. Who benefits from the volatility? And those are platforms such as Interactive Brokers, Purple Group locally. I think the volatility is going to get a lot of people involved in the markets, either out of fear or out of excitement. Then you look at what markets are currently making waves. And as you say, unfortunately, you look at who's on the receiving end of other people's demise. In the UK and the European markets, we are seeing a decline in Mercedes-Benz, BMW sales, VW as well. And the winner, unfortunately, in that predicament is BYD. And so you're seeing how they're expanding across the emerging markets. And I think that's a great play on their front. And I think that's something to look at. Again, we all also in a digitizing market right now. And with digitizing, you want to see who's going to be beneficial on that front. Amazon, the Magnificent Seven are well aligned to benefit from that. And then lastly, one of my favorites is Autodesk. It's a software company where if you want to build something, you are going to touch that software. And that's another one I think is going to benefit at this moment.
So betting on the winners seems like that's the kind of year it's going to be, especially as the volatility kind of persists. Odd, but before we wrap things up, I want to take a look at some of the local movements. We saw that financial stocks were down about 1.6%. We saw that industrials were kind of okay. Resources down more than 1%. And as you mentioned at the start of our chat, some of that was due to updates. We got that production update from Sasol. What's happening there? I mean, when I looked at the Sasol market, I remember I looked at it around 9 o'clock market open. The stock opened 5% down, and the market just didn't seem to like that update at all.
Yes, it was a very bad update, unfortunately. It's just showing that they are, in terms of production numbers, they are down across the board, in terms of chemicals, in terms of fuel as well, fuel sales. And they had some issues in Secunda as well with a fire there, and also some bad coal with the coal mining operation. So operation challenges for Sasol is really hurting them right now, and that was what brought those the drop in the share price.
What about Supergroup? Did you get a chance to look at the Supergroup update? I know they gave us a SENS announcement as well from their perspective.
Yes, I did have managed to look at that. We saw revenue and operating profits down double digits, looking around 19% on the bottom end, stating going by each segment of the business. Supply chain, there was a delay, obviously, with the ports and the unrest in the Mozambique, so that hurt their supply chain business. Dealerships as well in South Africa and the UK. UK suffering from the slow growth with BMW, VW, etc. They weren't moving as many units on that front. In South Africa, Chinese motor vehicles coming into the market, sucking oxygen away from that market as well. However, what I did see as a positive on that front is the sale of the SG fleet. I think that definitely is going to help them in terms of their balance sheet and strengthening that on that front.
As you heard it, folks, Odwa says bet on the winners if you can find them. The markets are certainly providing opportunities, and it's about identifying what those opportunities might look like. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Odwa, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Odwa Makhwenchu, who is the senior sales trader at Momentum Securities, joining me to take a look at some of the market movements happening, some sentiment around the world, as well as some of the SENS announcements we got locally.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So Murray & Roberts South Africa is in business rescue. That's going to affect the Murray & Roberts group business. And ordinarily, you'd think, okay, it's just one or two companies here and there. But actually, there's data that suggests that 1,400 plus companies went into business rescue in the 2024 year. Definitely an alarming number, definitely something we want to be looking at. And helping me take a look at that is the head of business rescue at Worksman's Attorneys, Dr. Eric Levenstein. Dr. Levenstein, good evening. Lovely to catch up with you as always. 1,400 businesses. That's a lot of businesses in business rescue. What's going on?
Well, in fact, the 1,400, Jimmy, are in fact companies that have gone into liquidation. The business rescue stats are not as clear as what we get out of Stats South Africa when it comes to those companies filing for liquidation. But what it does reflect is the number of casualties we have in relation to companies that didn't have the opportunity to go into business rescue and where, in fact, they've had to close their doors in 2024. But you are correct, 1,400 businesses having to close their doors is a large number. It's concerning because jobs are lost when a company goes into liquidation. And what does concern me is those companies potentially could have considered business rescue as a restructuring option, and maybe the directors never had the opportunity to consider business rescue, and maybe some of those companies could have been rescued and saved.
Dr. Levenstein, as you rightly mentioned, liquidation is kind of what comes after the business rescue process. In some cases, it's the process that happens right at the end. There's nothing you can do about it from that perspective. How do we get businesses prepared for these? Are we able to kind of pick out what is causing these trends? I mean, you and I spoke about insolvencies and liquidations and that in our previous conversation, but from a business rescue perspective, how do we kind of start to identify when businesses are in danger?
So, Jimmy, you know, you have warning signals. obviously trading becomes difficult, companies can't pay their suppliers, cash might be tight, there might be all sorts of reasons why a company hits that distress curve. And the real issue is whether or not directors and management understand what their options are. Now, of course, anyone can file for liquidation and close your doors. But since 2011, we've had the business rescue statute on our books. But I'm not so sure how many directors understand how it works. You know, who are the business rescue practitioners? What can they do? What are the outcomes and objectives of the business rescue process? So when a company hits a situation where it's making continued losses, struggling with an obligation to pay your creditors, maybe a shrinking customer base or a loss of market value, and just generally losing ground within what you do every day, that's when I think advice has to be taken, either from a restructuring advisor or from a financial advisor, and potentially from a legal advisor as to looking at the Companies Act, seeing whether business rescue is an option or whether the company should in fact close its doors and file for liquidation. So it comes down to an understanding of the legislation and what your optionality looks like.
Now, Dr. Levenstein, this is something that you do quite often at Worksmans with your team, is deal with these sorts of conversations around business rescue. And I imagine you've dealt with more cases than you care to imagine or care to remember. From what you've seen in all these experiences, are there cases where you're able to kind of draw on some of the patterns that companies are perhaps going through that might shed some insights?
Yeah, so patterns are fairly consistent, and unfortunately the pattern that we see is that directors and management leave it too late. In other words, where there's not much left to rescue, the company is too far gone. Let's say your suppliers and creditors have lost faith in the ability of the company to turn around or restructure its debt. And that's when obviously business rescue doesn't work. But when you introduce the business rescue conversation much earlier on the distress curve, then you obviously have a greater opportunity to restructure the company through the legislation. And rescue is all about appointing an independent practitioner. He or she comes along, takes a look at what's going on with your creditors, what's going on with the business, and files a business rescue plan, which A, compromises historical debt and provides the company and its stakeholders with an opportunity to consider alternatives. And provided you appoint the right business rescue practitioner early enough, as I said, in the distress curve, there you have the opportunity to rescue the company and in fact provide it with a fresh start. The big issue, of course, is you leave behind your historical debt, you start afresh, and you can continue to trade after the business rescue plan has been approved. It's about appointing the right professionals and getting the right advice much earlier in the distressed phase that a company goes through.
Dr. Levenstein, as part of business rescue, I imagine everything is done during that process, as the name suggests, to rescue the business and try and save the business from actually going the liquidation route or from having more adverse situations come out of it. What are some of the easy wins that you can kind of put in place as a business that's potentially staring down the barrel of business rescue, or that might be saying, we want to kind of just put in place mitigation strategies ahead of time in the event that someday this happens? Because the reality is we never really know what's going to happen in business, and sometimes pandemic will happen, sometimes your suppliers will disappear, but are there things that businesses can do to just say, we've got, you know, an extra line of credit we're not using, it's there for emergencies? Is that something that businesses should be looking at?
Absolutely, Jimmy. And it's about, I think, in the main cash flow. You know, a company has creditors. It's got to pay its debts as and when they fall due. If you are dealing with your creditors on a 30-day basis, 60-day basis, 90-day basis, once you start falling behind that curve, that's probably the clearest warning signal that there's probably a looming need for either an intervention, whether it's a business rescue or liquidation. So I think about navigating through those kind of parameters is very important. Obviously, getting proper advice as to what directors' obligations are, as set out in the Companies Act, and where you don't want to go down a line of reckless trading in a situation where you cannot pay your debts. And I think the other important aspect is opening up lines of communication with your bankers, not making sure they're not the last to know that you are are about to file for a business rescue. That's number one. And number two, speaking to your suppliers and making sure that they understand the constraints that the business might be trading under in relation to payment of its debts. And I think a plan, or let's say a mitigation plan, as you put it, is something which should be a part and parcel of a company's, let's say, infrastructure or ability to, if things fall off the curve, or let's say over the cliff, you at least have a fallback position as to how you're going to deal with that situation. So it's about being proactive and being in a position where you can act properly should you become financially distressed.
Mm. Dr. Levenstein, when I think about examples like Murray and Roberts that have been in the news lately, and you think about the size of a company like that and the order book that they had at one stage, and you compare them to other business rescue things that have happened, clearly the pattern here, or the lesson here, is that no business, regardless of size, is immune from potentially falling into this kind of situation. So it doesn't matter how big your business is or how small your business is, you're always at risk.
Absolutely. And it's completely industry agnostic. It affects all sorts of industries. I've been involved in business rescue for many, many years, and I've had all sorts of companies file for rescue, whether it's mining, infrastructure, let's say airlines, retail, manufacturing. So it really is completely agnostic when it comes to which companies might be affected by rescue. But the size of the company, I would say most rescues would work in small, medium enterprises and perhaps the larger ones. And we've seen some good examples. I mean, for example, South African Airways, yes, it went into business rescue. It is trading. It might be still struggling. That's a good example. Comair was one which didn't work out and went into liquidation. But when you take a company like Edcon, it sold off portions of its business to other companies, and it continues to trade, even though under new management or under new owners. And other examples of where restructuring has helped companies through the business rescue process. So I don't think it's about size. I think it's about basically using the business rescue mechanism in a clever way, and in a way which provides breathing space for the company to go through a restructuring phase, deal with historical debt, compromise it down, and start again. It doesn't have to end up in liquidation.
Mm. Dr. Levenstein, when we reflect back on the 1,400 businesses that went into liquidation last year, could any of them have been saved?
I think that a lot of companies, as I said much earlier, leave it too late. So if you are looking at a rescue plan where your creditors are already banging down your door with summonses and sending in the sheriff and applying for your liquidation, I think you're already too far gone. So a lot of those companies, if they had engaged, let's say, with advisors or perhaps their attorneys at a much earlier stage in the distress curve, they might have had the opportunity to consider a rescue plan. The real issue is, don't leave it too late. The later it is, there's going to be not much left to rescue. So you need to get in early, understand what the parameters look like and whether or not business rescue can work. And it can only work when you are at a much earlier phase on the distress curve.
Plan ahead, prepare yourself, and most importantly, if you need to have someone take a look at the business to help you out, get that done as soon as possible. Nobody wants to go into business rescue. Nobody wants to see a business being liquidated. But the reality is, this is still something that can happen. Thank you so much, Dr. Levenstein, for those insights. We'll leave the conversation there. Dr. Eric Levenstein, head of business rescue at Worksman's Attorneys, on the number of liquidations we saw last year, but also the growing trends that are emerging in the business rescue world.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's just gone 6:28. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with Moneyweb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And we're taking a look at an interesting collaboration between MTN, China Telecom, and Huawei in an effort to build or launch Africa's largest smart mine. I'm joined on the line by the General Manager for Enterprise Solutions at MTN South Africa, Sudipto Moitra, to take a look at this. Sudipto, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. What's a smart mine?
Hello, Jimmy. Good evening to you and to all your listeners. Mining operations that has been done smartly by leveraging all the modern technologies is what is generally referred as smart mine.
When you think about a mine, Sudipto, I mean, I have a bit of experience in the mining space. When you think about mining, particularly in the underground context, you don't often connect that to telecommunications and connectivity, because the obvious thing there is there's no signal, there's signal interruptions and all of that. So how do you get around that in the mining world, and how do you create a connected mine when half of the things might be underground but also might be very far away from each other?
That's a great point, Jimmy, and that's exactly what leads to smart mining. You know, whether it's open pit mine or closed mine, it's that connection across the board that is critical, and that connectivity is the bedrock of implementing modern technologies at a mine. So the way to sort of go about it, there are various ways. There is no like one sort of single formula that the mines are implementing. But what we talk about from an MTN perspective, and this collaboration that you spoke about with China Telecom and Huawei, is around what we call private network. So it's effectively creating a private network for that mining environment that connects, the underground mines, and then to have seamless technologies that can work on top of that connectivity.
What does that connectivity then do for the business? Because I imagine there's some things that you want to have benefit from that connectivity. I can think about things like reports that need to come out and data that needs to be sent through. Having the ability to transmit that kind of data almost instantaneously compared to not having connectivity surely makes a mining operation more efficient.
Absolutely, Jimmy. I mean, the key part that most of the mines are trying to drive, obviously, health and safety is the number one priority, together with the operational efficiency. There are a lot of use cases in the mine, you know, once you have the connectivity, and not just the connectivity, but, the high speed, the ultra reliable, the proper throughput, you know, so that we can look at the modern use cases that the mines need, whether it is, vehicle tracking, you know, which is gadgeted law in a lot of South African mines, or whether it is looking at, the health and safety use cases. So, there are various use cases across the value chain of the mine that can be then be enabled to bring in the smart mining execution.
Sudipto, what are some of the challenges with deploying a system like this, or deploying systems like this? Because I imagine it's not one single system that you're going to have to deploy to link up everything and all of that. What are some of the challenges that come with wanting to connect a mine, or connectify, if that's even a word, the mining space?
Right. I think from a technology perspective, the technology is proven. The private network 5G that we are talking about, globally, you know, a lot of mines have already implemented that, and they are in kind of advanced maturity curve. What we are seeing is the commercialization of these solutions. That is the key. A lot of mines, if they are having operational cost challenges, how do they let go? Based on this modern technology, the OPEX. Or if there is capital investments that might be hard to come by at these mines, how do you kind of make it look, and make that investment to look at the TCO and the return of investment? So one of the key things is commercializing these solutions, these technologies. It's not about proving the technologies, and then also doing it at scale, because the mines, depending on whichever mines we are talking about, it's not just doing a proof of concept in a small area to look at a small little use case, but it's about making it mainstream across the mine. So those are some of the challenges which we believe in the short to medium term, as these technology becomes a lot more operational, they will become also quite commercially viable.
Sudipto, you mentioned the fact that international mines and other mines around the world are already kind of using connectivity and technology to enhance mining operations. Do you kind of have an idea of some of the really good use cases, perhaps, where, like you said, we're seeing things around vehicle tracking and all of that can be made more efficient, but some of those really unique cases where this might not have even been a possibility without the use of technology?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we are seeing globally, the global trends are showing the convergence of what is called information technology, IT, together with operational technology, OT. So there are a lot more matured use cases across the mines, you know, where this convergence is actually live. And to your point, Jimmy, there are a lot of these over and above, you know, the technologies that are there in the mine. You know, the transformation elements are then being implemented to make the mine more efficient.
Sudip, I'm thinking about I think it was Volvo that said they wanted to look at autonomous vehicles. Now, we're talking about connectivity in mining, and that came to mind because I'm thinking you can't really achieve full autonomy, especially if these vehicles are using things like satellites and mapping and all of the technology that goes into making them autonomous. You definitely need to have connectivity. Is this kind of where we're seeing the future of mining transition to? I mean, you guys are able to bring the tech side of it to the party, and then you can then start to have the conversations around modern use cases that involve autonomous vehicles.
Yeah, spot on, Jimmy. I think autonomous vehicle is one of those profound use cases that is becoming mainstream on the back of, 5G private network. And definitely, you know, earlier I spoke about vehicle collision avoidance, you know. So there has been a lot of technologies, whether it is the RFID technologies or these days the OEM of the different vehicles, you know, they have all got the technology that works. But the most important implementation is the seamless execution of this across the mine. Again, not in a particular patch or a particular area, but as the vehicles are kind of transcending across the mines, you know, and these are heavy utility vehicles, you know, can they be fully autonomous? And more importantly, it's not just the autonomous mining or the vehicles, it's about the data that they're bringing to bear and how do you then mine the data, you know, to make it more effective and go into the smart mining mode. So those are some of the trends that we are seeing across the mining sector, across the value chain.
So, Sudipta, what next for a company like MTN? I mean, obviously, you are involved in the Northern Cape Manganese Mine where this project is taking place. But over and above that, the MTN Group operates on the African continent. There's many mines on the African continent. Where do you guys kind of see the transition happening from your role where it comes to the mining space?
Yeah, Jimmy, I think at MTN, you know, we are going through our own transformation of what we call a telco to a techco. And by becoming a techco, it allows us to bring this modern technologies. And I believe is that, you know, especially private network and leveraging technologies like 5G is going to fundamentally reshape, redefine various industries. So the future, as we see, is, you know, we always believe at MTN that everybody deserves the benefit of modern connected life. So together with the connectivity, how do we move up the stack of IT? How do we leverage the other telco assets that we have? And as you rightly said, Jimmy, this is not just a story in South Africa, but across all the countries we operate on the continent, we believe that we can reshape this industries. We can bring in the 4IR technologies, and with the modern trends of AI, with the modern trends of other technologies of convergence of IT and OT, we want to play a pivotal role in reshaping some of these businesses. And together with that, you know, serving the community. Making maybe be the first in the world to reshape some of these industries by bringing in the likes of private network and 5G technologies.
Smart mining, the future's definitely here. It's a very interesting future, and it's always nice to see that technology can come in to improve things. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Sudipta. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. General Manager for Enterprise Solutions at MTN South Africa, Sudipta Moitra, joining us to take a look at smart mining and the attempt at launching the largest 5G smart mine in collaboration with China Telecom, Huawei, and MTN, of course. That looks to be a mine that's going to be taking off, a manganese mine that's going to be taking off in the Northern Cape.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. As the World Economic Forum wraps up in Davos, Switzerland this week, we will be reflecting on some of the outcomes from there. We know that there's been a lot of topics that have been conversational pieces. We've seen the likes of our central bank governor speak there. We've also seen the president outline what it is that we have from an objective point of view. If you remember earlier in the week, we also spoke to Business Unity South Africa's Kaz Kuvadia around that as well, around what South Africa was looking to get out of this. We're going to be taking a look at some of the key areas that could potentially be of benefit for South Africa and the African continent. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of Corporate and Investment Banking at Standard Bank Group, Luvuyo Masinda, to take a look at this. Good evening, Luvuyo. Thanks so much for taking the time. Now, infrastructure has been such a big talking point, from the president's investment drives all the way through to what we've heard ministers say about turning South Africa into one big construction site. What is the current state of Africa's infrastructure, whether we're looking at roads, railways, and all sorts of other things?
Thanks, Jimmy, for having me. I suppose the starting point is why infrastructure? And, you know, through many literature, it's very evident that investment in infrastructure is such a huge multiplier in its effect in economic growth. So it's an obvious place to focus on. And also it's a big opportunity to increase employment and grow employment. And that's why actually across globally, but particularly in Africa, that's been a key focus. In Africa, it's got an added important context in that when you consider the needs of the continent, both in its ability to facilitate trade, to support economies to grow, and just in general social infrastructure, there's definitely been a lag. When you look at the various quotes, there is a gap of roughly $100 billion dollars per annum that is required just to catch up, which then tells you the challenges that we see with the Africa infrastructure across its various segments, whether it's the road infrastructure, the hard infrastructure of road, rail, water, and some of the soft ones, social ones, specifically around healthcare and schools and the likes. And so there's a lot of work that's required to be done in Africa, but it provides a great opportunity for the continent.
That opportunity is not a cheap opportunity. I mean, infrastructure development surely is one of the most expensive kind of investment or capital intensive exercises. How do we kind of reconcile that mismatch? We know that the African continent needs infrastructure, but at the same time, it also needs the capital for that infrastructure. How do we harness the capital? How do we make African infrastructure an attractive investment opportunity?
No, you're absolutely correct, Jimmy, in that firstly, this is not a new phenomenon. And part of the difficulty that has sort of stood in the way for us to achieve our aspirations across the continent has been the expensive nature of infrastructure. There's been other challenges around policy and the consistency of policy and transparency of policy to invite private capital. That's probably one of the biggest shifts that we're seeing, whether it's in South Africa. We've seen it first in the energy sector, specifically in South Africa, around the renewable independent power producer programs. That's been exceptionally successful in bringing the partnership between private and the public sector. And I think there's a realization across the continent that is that model, because there's just not sufficient capital on the continent to fund what is required. And so that's probably been the biggest shift, and the discussions that have taken place is firstly, how do we mobilize and find these pools of capital, and how do we access them in a manner that suits the needs of the continent? And lastly, how do we make it affordable? And so that's been quite a bit of the discussions. And, you know, from ourselves as a bank, Standard Bank, the largest bank on the continent, we think we play a very critical role. Our aspiration is to support the growth of Africa, and that will include using our own resources, financial resources. But actually, more importantly, is to find areas of collaboration, of finding these pools of capital, structuring in the way that makes sense for the African continent needs, and then making it available for the right projects.
Luvuyo, the capital side of it is one aspect of it. The other side of it is the policies. A lot of infrastructure development sits with kind of within the public sector, less within the private sector, especially from a South African point of view, when I think around things like Eskom, Transnet, and the big parastatals. And accompanying the public sector conversation is a policy conversation. A lot of the time, there's a hesitancy to invest because policy is unclear. What could be done from that perspective to kind of bridge the gap, meet halfway, so that those that come from the capital side of it that say we want to put capital in are at least assured that policy will not be lagging and policy will actually help speed up the development of the infrastructure?
Well, firstly, I mean, I suppose that's a part of the power of, conferences like the World Economic Forums, in that you have got a mix of both, regulators on one end or policymakers on one end and the capital. And so there's a piece around actually policymakers actually having a very clear understanding on from the capital supply side on what are some of the challenges. But if you bring it to South Africa and you consider some of the progress we've made, I've made an example of what you've seen in the energy sector. When you consider now the steps that have been taken around our transport logistic sector and the move even for Transnet as an example towards more partnership with the private sector, it's clear in our mind that that message is starting to land. It's just a matter of, can we do it quicker? Because we operate in a very competitive environment. The longer we wait to put the policies in place that creates the enabling environment, we might lose out to some of our neighboring countries who might act faster. So I think the discussion around what needs to be done has become much more clearer. It's whether we can act with speed and whether we have the appropriate people capacity or human capital capacity throughout the value chain across both the capital providers and, more importantly, on the policy side.
The continent is hungry for growth. There are capital allocators like Standard Bank waiting to assist in that growth. We just need to get our ducks in a row and be on the same page about the conversations that we are having. But the opportunity is definitely there. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Luvuyo. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Luvuyo Masinda, who is the CEO of Corporate and Investment Banking at the Standard Bank Group. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So my producer decided to share with me an interesting video that she saw online that had a gentleman in the video saying that in 2025, he intends to supply Woolworths food with tilapia fish. The gentleman in question is a gentleman by the name of Banele Rao. He joins me now for our SME of the week. He's the founder of a business called Z2B Aquaponics Farm. And we're going to take a look at what that business does. Good evening, Banele. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Z2B Aquaponics Farm. What is it that you guys do?
Thank you very much for actually having me on the show, first of all. And yeah. Z2B Aquaponics Farm, we are based in Soweto, and in the last 2 years, we started a journey, and we documented the journey. We built it in public, with the public involved, where we said, let's build a business, and let's take it from zero to a million. And because it's a community initiative, we asked for ideas, and one of the ideas was, let's do aquaponics. And then we decided to do aquaponics, which basically means we are farming tilapia and catfish in Soweto.
You're farming fish in Soweto. Tell me how that works.
We are farming fish in Soweto. Yeah. So now what's happening is you have what is called aquaponics, where you have both aquaculture, which would be the farming of just fish. And then you would have hydroponics, which would then be farming crops. But you do not place them on the ground. You actually use a circulating system of water. Now, when you put these things together, when you put these two systems together, you have what is called aquaponics. Now, the fish that are in the water, as they lay waste in the water, that water is drained out and it supplies nutrients to plants, all right, and crops. And then when the crops get those nutrients and as they live, they then inject oxygen into the water, and then it goes back to feed the fish. So now this is a cyclical system where you are both farming fish and at the other end you're farming crops. That is the system that we built.
Why did you decide to go this route? I mean, of all the businesses that you could have started, I know that there must be a need for it somewhere, but why go this route and what inspired the business?
The opportunities in terms of the business itself and the idea of a food security really resonated with me. I mean, let's think about when you have an apple or you have meat, right? It has probably been transported for kilometers, maybe thousands, maybe hundreds of kilometers. You know how that is expensive in itself. But imagine this, right? If we have a farm in a place like a Soweto, a township, places that were not designed to produce food. Now, think of the distance between the actual farm itself and a potential retailer. It's very short. Now, we're talking less CO2 emissions. Now, when you see, or when you look at the kind of meat that is accessed in the townships, right? When we're talking about like the lower LSM groups, way lower, right? You'd find that they are buying meat, but that meat is not nutritious. It's not nutritious because it's sort of like a rejects to call it what they are, you know? So now I said, how about we go and start this business as it was suggested by the community, and then we farm something that is nutritious, with high nutritional value, but most importantly, it is affordable. So it means that if we have our own smaller little farms in the townships, we will be able to give our people high nutritional value protein, but with less cost. So it made sense for us to actually go the route aquaponics. And then when you look at it in a totally business perspective, there is no competition basically in terms of farming in the township. And we knew that this is going to be innovative. It is going to catch people's attention, and it is going to basically catapult us into the public space where they're going to say, we want to hear about aquaponics. Then we are the ones that are introducing it.
You didn't stop there, Banele. You didn't just build that side of the business. You also went on to build a wholesale stockfell side of the business for distribution and all of that. Take me through that side of the business and how you then kind of linked the two.
Haha. Now, when we went into aquaponics, right, we understand that there's going to take us a lot of time to get people to get accustomed to buying fish. That's the first. And then the second is that we would then have a very short window by the time we are done farming the fish. When you're dealing with agriculture, you have a very limited time between harvesting and selling. So now we figured out that we needed to build our own retail outlet, right? So if we were going to farm the fish first and then have the fish maybe harvested and ready, let's give it maybe a week. We can't go knocking at doors such as your Woolworths, some your Pick and Pays, and all the other retailers with the fish. It's not going to work. By the time that we get any word from them or any interest from them, we wouldn't have any fish. So we decided, let's then build our own retail small outlet. That gave birth to EZ2B, AEA2, meat wholesale. Now, what we sell at the meat wholesale is the meat that South Africans are familiar with, which will be poultry, which will be also beef. Now, what we were doing over the past year is that we were collecting data from people that were buying from us. They were getting used to us selling them meat while we were growing our fish. So we were putting ourselves in a position where when the fish is ready, we will just simply put it in a packet and introduce it to our customers. So we anticipated a situation far ahead where we don't want to grow the crops, or we don't want to grow the fish and only to struggle with introducing it to the market. So that's how these two the businesses basically are in the same value chain together. Our intention is to now collaborate with bigger retailers and actually provide them as any farm would do. On the part of the stock sale came about as if you, as a South African, you would know that when it comes to businesses, we struggle a lot with the one thing, funding. Everyone is always complaining. Every entrepreneur will tell you about funding. So if you have an idea, you can't take that idea to the bank and say, bank, I have just an idea. You have to have records, you have to have performance, you have to have all of these things. But what is the one thing that South Africans have that is accessible? It is a stock sale. We do that for funerals, we do that for the groceries. So I said, okay, let's approach this manner in a stock sale style, which is crowdfunding. And I said, community, let's come together, let's pitch in what you can, right? And then from then on, we establish a business. My vision is to see ourselves having stock sales that are coming together to fund and build businesses that then become profitable. So the stock sale and the crowdfunding part is a very key aspect at the start of the business. And then when it comes to scaling, then we can work with the banks.
You've thought all of this through, Banele. Clearly, the business is well on track. How do people get in touch with the business? How do people get hold of you? How do people that want to try out the products, that want to be part of the community, how do people reach you?
So for sales, you can go to Z2B. So it's Z2B, foodbev.co.za. It's Z2B, foodbev.co.za. You will then read about us and you'll find our products there. Personally, where I use my own platforms to talk about the business and everything that is involved in the business and our journey, it is Banele Reo. So that's Banele Reo. And I'm on all social networks.
Z2B foodbev.co.za. That is the website to get hold of the Z2B Aquaponics family. If you want to get hold of Banele directly, he is at Banele Rewo, R-E-W-O, on all socials. So reach out to them and perhaps they can change how you're viewing your consumption of some of the essentials that you are enjoying at the moment. I certainly love a business that knows their market and a business that knows their product, and this is what we've got for this week's SME. Thanks so much, Banele, for giving us some insight into your business. We wish your business all of the very best in the journey that you are going through. We wish you all the best growth, and we hope to see you guys continue to do well.
Thank you very much.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience, it's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
My name is Frank Leonet, CEO and founder of South Africa's newest crypto exchange called Afridex. I will be on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast with Karen Ryan to explain why we believe South Africa could benefit from a new crypto exchange and how we differ from the existing exchanges. Join us this week to find out more.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've come to the end of our show, folks. We've come to the end of our week. I'm off to go and listen to President Donald Trump tell us about how America is going to be the artificial intelligence and crypto capital of the world. Yes, he's speaking at the moment. And as in typical Donald Trump fashion, it could go in any which direction. I'm going to leave you on that note because that's going to be the difficult conversations that we have going into the weekend and trying to understand what President Donald Trump is saying, and that's going to be our lives for the next 4 years. But if you missed any of our conversations this week, be sure to catch up with them online. All the podcasts are up online, so you can go revisit them. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.